Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
You are listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprungs disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprungs with a positive message throughout.
Hello and welcome to episode 98 of Tom's Hirschsprungs podcast. I am delighted to be joined all the way from New Zealand, Courtney Crawford. Courtney, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's an honour, really. Honestly, it's the first time I've actually met anyone with Hirschsprungs disease.
Oh, really? I do hear that. I mean, to be honest, I've before starting this podcast, I was in the same situation. We kind of end up thinking, we know we're not the only ones. We kind of feel a little bit like it sometimes. I don't know if you're very similar to that, where you know that there are people, there must be someone out there with Hirschsprungs, otherwise we wouldn't have been diagnosed with it. But at the same time, it's, we're not exactly, you know, you're not exactly going to bump into five Hirschsprungs people on the street.
Well, after I got my GP changed to one who was looking after me post-surgery, which I'll discuss shortly. He had been in the medical field for about 40-something years, and he said I was his second client with Hirschsprung's disease. So he was just a bit baffled and kind of overwhelmed by the whole thing.
I can imagine he was, yeah. I mean, it's again, it's something that, I don't know, we'll probably go into this a little bit later, but especially when you see GPs about it, there are some which are great, fantastic, you know, that they'll at least heard of the condition, and there are some, quite a few, who don't, or they sort of misunderstand, I guess, what it might be. But if we kind of go back to, I guess, the beginning of your story, would you like to start from there?
We'll go to the very beginning where I was diagnosed with encopresis, and we're going to call that a misdiagnosis now. I was 7 years old, and I was in and out of hospital trying to get my gut to function properly. And now encopresis was, I had been told it was where I couldn't control my bowel movements. So there were periods where I was completely backed up, and then other periods where I was just having to get cleaned out completely, which not fun, especially for a primary school kid. But post that and being hospitalized with a nose tube, my bowel didn't exactly work properly. I was having a movement once every couple of weeks. I thought, okay, well, maybe I've experienced some permanent damage. So as long as things are moving along, sweet as, it's the way it is. And then we're going to speed up to January last year, 2024. I was having some challenges, and that was my last bowel movement back in January 2024 prior to surgery. By March, I had taken a holiday for the first time in 6 months because I was working full time at that phase and hiding it from everyone that I was having some serious gut discomfort. I was bloated. I was passing gas. Sorry for the, I don't know how blunt up would be about this.
Go for it. Honestly. I mean, the things I've heard, you wouldn't believe. So yeah, absolutely go for it. Be as graphic and as detailed as you like.
But yeah, so I was hiding it from my workmates and all of that. So when I ended up in hospital, everyone was kind of like, what the heck has happened? I was throwing up on holiday with my friend, and my friend was like, I need to take you to hospital. This is not right. I was about 5 hours away from home, and I thought, no, I'm going to go to my GP as soon as I get back to Auckland, which is where I was living at that time, get help from her. The problem with that GP I had was she was the token doctor for certain demographics here in New Zealand. And I think there was a bit of a loss in translation, loss of culture understanding around the whole thing. And I also with being in Auckland, you know, you see a person, you spit them out, see a person, spit them out. It's very just kind of, yeah. And I needed someone who was going to not only advocate for me, but also really investigate. And she didn't. She really didn't. And so I went to her in April after I got back from a holiday, because I had to wait for 2 weeks to get that help. And then from there, well, after that appointment, I was given suppositories, enemas, laxatives. None of it worked. None of it worked at all. There was no flow. It was all completely blocked. I, at the time, I didn't know. I was just not feeling great. And then I went back a month later and said, this is not working. Can we try something else? Which is where she gaslit me on my sugar levels, because I was tired as heck, barely sleeping, and just struggling to focus at work and trying to stay awake, going to and from work. I was falling asleep on the public transport. And so I got chastised for that. I was then patronized and condescending and told to change my diet and eat different foods and all that sort of thing. And she gave me some Laxol and dismissed me, basically, just like that. 3 weeks later, I had a really good flatmate, Calvin, who had been in my ear for about a week. And he was just every day going, go to the hospital, go to the hospital, go to the hospital. And to a point where I was, one night I had eaten a homemade mince pie, which was delicious, but not so great when you're throwing it up the next morning, unfortunately. So I tried, I hopped in the hot shower to kind of alleviate some of the pain. And I was so bloated. I looked about 9 months pregnant, and the front of my stomach was so hard, which is why I think I delayed it for so long, because I was scared it was gut cancer, just by how hard my front of my stomach was. And after the shower, I was bleeding from the rectum, and I got so frightened by that. I'm like, I can't ignore this anymore. I'm done. I'm going to walk into ED. So I walked into the reception and said, I haven't had a bowel movement in 5 months. And they're like, right, you're off triage straight away. Like, we're going to try and get this sorted. One of the ED doctors tried to give me laxatives and dismiss me and discharge me straight away again. Thankfully, there was actually a Scottish doctor there who looked at me, felt my stomach, and thought, no, I want a CT of this. I want to have a look and actually get a good picture. I had obstruction in my large colon that was 1 meter long. My rectum itself was 10 centimeters dilated from impaction. So I've permanently damaged my rectum. They tried 3 or 4 procedures of disimpaction, which ended up ripping my rectum, and I had to get it surgically stitched up and Botox slightly to help heal it. And he's like, right, we're going to take you in and go in for surgery. I'm going, can I have a day's rest? Because this, like, I can't even sit on my backside right now. I'm sore. So he explained the colostomy and the fact that I was going to go in for it. 1 hour later, the advocate specialist came and introduced the whole thing and explained a little bit, draw a circle on my stomach where the hole was going to go. And then 2 days later, I went in for surgery and woke up with a colostomy. So with the Hirschsprungs and how it came around was, I had actually hit up my father, who lives here in Tarangire, where I live now, and gone, hey, Dad, I don't want you to panic, but I'm in hospital. And he's like, holy cow. Like, drops everything, gets to Auckland. And so the moment he comes in prior to my big surgery, and my surgeon was going, we think it's Hirschsprungs, you're ticking every the boxes. And my dad is like, oh yeah, she all those boxes are ticked. She's had this problem since she was 3 or 4. And I think that changed their attitude and their panic around the whole thing and where I was at. So it was kind of good to have him there. But also I was spiraling, going, why didn't I know this information? Why did I not, you know, have this? They did a biopsy during the procedure of the colostomy for the Hirschsprungs. It came back negative. And then post-surgery, I went back 6 months later, December last year, to do another biopsy after I had healed some. And I have found out when they do the biopsies for Hirschsprungs, it's actually really difficult to fully diagnose it, because they have to get the right piece of the intestine to come back and actually say, yes, it's Hirschsprungs. Both biopsies are gone. Well, it's kind of inconclusive. We're not 100% sure, but you've ticked every box. I'm going, okay, well, there is no other explanation for this. And my gut has died on me. It was diseased by the time they took it out, and it was a 4 meter of blockage. So I've lost 2/3 of my large intestine. And I am now part of the stoma community at 34 years old. But yeah, so that's a very, very short kind of explanation of it. But I mean, when I left Auckland and came to Tarangire, I asked for my document records. And this is dating back to when I was about 3 or 4 years old. And we're talking about 90 something pages here, roughly, of file documents from my GPs, from specialists here in Tauranga when I was a child, all of it. So it was the Hirschsprung, the decompressus diagnosis, my hospitalization with cleaning my gut out, all of it. And when I saw it, I just spiraled. Yeah. So that's basically my story. And since then, I mean, it's really cool to connect with people who have stomas, but it's hard to find someone with Hirschsprung's.
It is. You're absolutely right. And that's a heck of a story, by the way. That is a heck of a story. And again, for those who are audio listening to this rather than watching on YouTube, that is a hefty stack of paper you've got there. I mean, you know, that is for anyone with Hirschsprung's, and I was very similar. You know, you have the biggest folder out of, you know, generally most people in the hospital. I can remember that for myself, you know, whenever, because they bring the trolley through with all of the folders, and I always knew when I was next because mine is the biggest. And I imagine it's similar for you as well.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I didn't even know that my large intestine had turned necrotic when I was in hospital. It was post-surgery, and my younger sibling, I say sibling because of their identity, is actually a vet nurse. So they have some familiarization of jargon, I guess you could say. And one of the nurses had actually accidentally left their note-taking computer at the door of my bedroom. So my sister, well, sibling, had walked to the computer, taken a look and saw the word necrotic. And I was like, wow.
Wow, that's not great.
Yeah, I was days away from sepsis, and I was very lucky, but also thankful that I didn't have to fight my recovery and fight the sepsis, because it hadn't yet kind of ruptured and infected me.
Yeah, I mean, sepsis is obviously, you know, I've met a few people who've had it. I mean, I had it myself, and it's not something to be messed with. It's very, very, very serious stuff. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's the things that really get me is the medical, yeah, gaslighting, really. I mean, and that kind of, you know that something is wrong. I mean, all the symptoms you described, you know, sort of having something that is very, very clearly, you know, a major issue, and being told, oh, well, it's your diet. Oh, it's, you know, this and that and the other. I mean, that's extraordinary, really. That wasn't, you know, people didn't investigate that further or go, actually, that, you know, and it took another doctor after you'd already been to the hospital then to take another doctor to go, actually, but thankfully that doctor was there and saw you, you know, because otherwise it would be obviously a awful situation.
Well, the one who actually said, I want a CT, because he was really kind of concerned, he was the first one who actually touched my stomach physically and thought, that hardness is not right. That shouldn't be what it is. And so that kind of justified the CT, and that instigated the whole process of speeding things up. So, I mean, if I ever met him, I would love to just thank him, basically, because he was the decision to get me admitted. I would definitely say it was very difficult, because I had to learn to walk again and learn to sit up again post-surgery. I had a laparotomy, so which is a huge incision from your rib cage straight through the middle of your belly down to past your belly button, and it's about 20 to 30 centimeters long. So I lost my core muscles for about, I'm going to say, the better part of 4 weeks. It took me a week to sit, and it took me 2 weeks to walk. And that's just walking around the ward. And I got discharged 2.5 weeks after surgery, basically. And then I spent 3 weeks at my family home, where it was hard enough kind of trying to walk around, and then walk to the end of my driveway, and then walk the next milestone was walking 450 meters to the dairy to grab a drink, and then walk back again. And that was definitely a very, very hard part about it, and building my strength up again. I mean, I lost 22 kgs in 2 weeks while I was hospitalized. I went from triple digits to down to double digits in the space of 2 weeks. It's funny, I remember when I had started walking, actually, I was just about to go back onto food, like solid food rather than liquids. And I would weigh myself one day and I would be like 99 kgs. And then 2 days later, I was down to 97. I was just going, how's this weight coming off me? Like, it's nuts. It really is. The piece that they took out of me was 6 kgs alone.
Well, that'll help, you know. That will take the weight loss down if they take out 6 kgs. Yeah. I mean, and you said you had a meter long blockage as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, that obviously, and with the stomach being so hard, obviously that's going to be weighing a lot as well, I would imagine.
Yeah. So, yeah, that whole meter weighed 6 kgs when they had fully removed it. I still try to come to terms with the fact that, like, it was rotten. It had died, which is just nuts. And during my recovery process at home, before I returned to work, when I definitely returned too soon, I resulted in having some PTSD, which I've had to resolve this year. And it's great that I've had that time to do that. And I've been ticked off. I'm all good. It was very difficult in trying to get painkillers and any other medication that I might need for day to day after discharge, because they kept telling me, no, you've got to go back to your doctor. I'm like, the doctor is the one that caused me to be where it was. Like, no, I'm not going to talk to her. Like, how? We opened up an investigation on her as a formal complaint, and it was handled internally and privately with the medical center. And I was able to get free nurse care for the remainder of 2024. I was able to get about 4 to 6 free sessions with my new GP. And I was also able to barter and get the best GP at the medical center. And he was the one that had been there for 40 years. And he told me at one point, he's just like, you're the second person I've come across with Hirschsprung's disease. And he's been in the medical field for 40 years. It's just, it's nuts to find out how rare it is. I've yet to meet someone who has gone as long as I have without being diagnosed for 33 years.
Yeah, same. I haven't seen that. I mean, and I meet people with Hirschsprung's every day. This is, again, really why I want you on, because your story, as well as being about Hirschsprung's, is fascinating. And 33 years. I mean, I've not seen kind of even half of that length. I mean, when, and again, for people who, because I have people who do listen to this show who are not, who don't have Hirschsprung's or don't necessarily know, a lot about it, but want to know more, the general diagnosis is within 48 hours. So 33 years and 48 hours is pretty far apart, you know. So that's what we're talking about here. Like, you know, we're not talking about not that there really is a straightforward case of Hirschsprung's. We're certainly not talking about a straightforward case of Hirschsprung's here, are we?
No, but I mean, like, so help me understand here. What, like, how do people live with Hirschsprung's without ending up in surgery like I have?
That's a really good question. I'm not a doctor, but I sometimes listen to stories and I listen to your story and I think, how on earth is that even possible to do that? To, you know, I mean, I'm kind of surprised all the blockage didn't happen a lot sooner, really.
Yeah, and it probably could have when I was about 7 years old, because I had memories as a child having toileting problems and having incidences at school where I couldn't control my bowels. And so obviously, like, they thought the problem was actually between my hips rather than in my actual intestines. And maybe that was the only sign of it, but maybe because of the lack of information understanding around Hirschsprung's here in New Zealand, they just diagnose it as encopresis, because that's about as common as Hirschsprung's. They're saying it's 1 in every 7 to 14 people have an episode of encopresis in their life, at least.
Yeah.
So maybe that's where the misdiagnosis happened. But when I was 7 years old, as I mentioned, I ended up in hospital. I was very, very blocked, very backed up and very uncomfortable. And so I remember it took 5 adults to pin me down on a hospital bed and shove a nose tube in to get me to take the laxatives. So I'm thinking, what is it called? The clean prep medication, to have it done through my nose and into my stomach to wash me out. And I had that nose tube for about 3 months of when I was about 7 years old. So I ended up going to school with it on at one point, I think, from some very light memory. It's very hard to recall.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. And you mentioned about, you know, kind of trauma and PTSD as well, and that is something I tend to see, not often, but I think it's more and more common as time's gone on with things like Hirschsprungs, because you are going, I mean, you go through an awful lot, and obviously you've been through a lot more than most, you know, and those kind of instances are going to, whether consciously or subconsciously, they are really going to affect us, I would imagine.
Yeah. So when I sought out some help through my GP, we got me aligned to speak to a psychologist who specializes in surgical trauma and just trauma in general. So she was able to help me through a method of, I'd like to kind of describe it like hypnotherapy. She gets you to close your eyes and visualize the trauma that you go through. And she does it so the trauma is on the TV screen and you're watching the TV screen and then you're watching yourself watch the TV screen. And so you're able to understand your emotions and where you're at, where you react and how, you know, what happens and how your emotions respond. So it helped me identify just getting so emotional and what my triggers were. And it was around the fact that I really lost autonomy and self-advocacy during my hospitalization process. It was the fact that in that kind of sense, I was in a hospital bed waiting to go in for surgery, and they were making me sign off documents going, okay, so in the CT, you know, your risk of, because of the radiation, your risk of getting cancer is increased by 5%. And you're going, okay, well, I don't want to risk cancer, but I don't want to, I want this problem resolved. So I'm going to have to sign it. And it's that whole, like, you have to do it for the anesthesia, you have to do it for so many things, going, okay, I don't want to feel this pain, I don't want to feel this discomfort, that if I don't proceed forward with what they're telling me to do, I'm not going to be here next week. And so your back is up against a hard wall, and having such a short time frame to go from, okay, you're going to get a stoma, to you wake up from with a stoma, 2 days?
Yeah.
It's not enough time for the brain to handle that. I mean, I've met so many people with Crohn's and colitis who battle their illnesses for a decade before they end up with a stoma. So they have that decade to fight the whole process and come to terms with the fact that they need one.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious to buy chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, that was a really good point you mentioned, actually, there. I was going to bring that up with your, just the time that took between, you know, there's no time to do any research. There's no time to do any, I mean, I know you said you had the patient advocate person come in and basically say, you know, this is effectively what a stoma is, you know, and this is what it's going to look like. But
yeah,
that's nowhere near enough information, you know, for something that is, I mean, it is life changing, you know, stomas, and there are, you know, they are huge parts of your life, you know, in terms of the way life changes. And to have that 2 to 48 hours to sort of process it, just simply isn't enough time, is it?
No. So it was definitely kind of a shock to hear my surgeon go, we're going to resolve it, but we're going to have to reroute your rectum, basically, and put it on your stomach. And we're going to have a specialist who advocates and speaks to people about getting stomas. So she showed what a bag looks like. She showed how it worked. And then she kind of got me to sit and stand and drew on my stomach where the hole was going to go, like I mentioned before. And we did it to try and navigate, you know, whether or not I would be able to change if I was sitting or if I was standing. And of course, at the time, I was so bloated, I looked 9 months pregnant. So we had put it in a location thinking, with me being so big, that's where it's going to sit. But of course, I lost a crack ton of weight. I'm happy with where it sits. But yes, it was definitely like, when she came in, I wish I had a chance to ask her questions. And I didn't get that opportunity because I didn't know what to ask.
I mean, it was religious in that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I mean, thankfully, I was actually part of... So I was in the older building when I was first admitted. After my surgery and I was able to sit up, they actually moved me to a brand new building that had opened up while I was recovering. So I was one of the first patients to be in the whole brand new building that handles, I guess you'd call them elective surgeries, but it really specializes in people who have massive gut issues, because between the old building and the new building is a hallway, and the hallway connects to the surgery room. So, yeah, that was a huge announcement on the news back in July last year about how it had opened, and it was really cool. So that meant that I ended up having my own bathroom and bedroom, which was nice to have that kind of privilege. And when you get admitted, you know, when you have a stoma, they have a tick, box you have to tick before you get discharged. It was eat solids and keep them down, be able to walk without a walker. And be able to shower on my own and be able to change my stoma on my own with no supervision. I had to tick those 4 boxes before they let me go, which was, you know, it was good. And it was interesting that they had that criteria, because when I relocated back to my family home here in Tauranga, I had nurses who visited the first 2 weeks every 2 or 3 days to help me change my stoma, and going, okay, well, if they're helping me, obviously there's a different standard of requirements down here in Tauranga, because apparently people get discharged from hospital without even knowing how to handle changing it. So, yeah, thankfully, now that I've relocated back to my family home back in March this year, I was able to find a fantastic doctor who really advocates and really loves to research and investigate. So I'm going to hold on to her as much as I can. I came across a person here in New Zealand who speaks on one of our radio shows called The Edge NZ. He's currently going through a colitis journey, and he has a phrase, and it's very much health is wealth, and yeah, which completely changes your aspect about your life and what your priorities.
Most I've heard that saying before, and it's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Mm-hmm. You know, when, and especially anybody who has been through surgery or chronic illness of any kind, you know the just how important health is. I mean, if you haven't been through that sort of journey, if you've generally you haven't had any operations, or you've generally just been pretty well, then first of all, great. But secondly, you possibly don't quite have the same perspective as somebody who's been through multiple surgeries, who's maybe had to advocate for themselves quite a lot. It really is. It's an excellent saying, but it is really something that sticks with, especially those, I think, with chronic illness.
Yeah. I was listening to one of your other podcasts a while ago, and I was wondering, is there a connection with the whole gut issue when it comes to Hirschsprung's and the immune system? How does that work?
Yeah, not a doctor. I don't know.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
The station that makes you feel good.
What people tell me, again, it's so different from person to person. That's why, like, Hirschsprung's is so difficult to sort of put in a box, really. It's so tricky. But yeah, I mean, people do tell me that they do have a slightly weakened immune system, or maybe slightly more susceptible to things like colds, coughs, things through the winter, because they have Hirschsprungs, or because potentially they've had a lot of surgeries as well. Again, this isn't medical advice, this is just what people have told me. Because they've had a lot of surgeries, so obviously you have more surgeries, you know, you have potentially weaker parts of the body and weaker immune system and all of that stuff. But it's, yeah, I mean, but that's just what some people have told me. But again, it's all individual. In terms of actual, like, proper science, I haven't seen anything. I mean, I think it's a great thing to be investigated. I think that would be something, you know, and it may be being investigated already and I just haven't seen it. And if anybody listening has, you know, because I do miss stuff, but if anybody has seen that, by all means, you know, drop me a message and send some stuff over to me or post it or whatever, because I think that's really, really interesting, because it's I think surgeries play a massive part in Hirschsprungs, just in general, because I think they do. I think, again, because a lot of surgeries, possibly not in your case, but a lot of surgeries are done when we're too young to speak, we're too young to really notice them or anything. But I think that plays a massive part on you as a person. So those types of surgeries, when you don't necessarily know what's going on. But it's, yeah, I don't know what you think about that as well.
I mean, we can always go, we could have, should have, didn't kind of process, and the whole looking back and what had did and didn't happen. Because with myself, I mean, having gut issue problems as a child and having those accidents at school and being hospitalized with what we thought was encephalitis, if they had done a bit more of an in-depth investigation, or if Hirschsprungs was a bit better known, maybe I might have ended up with a stoma at a younger age, maybe. Or I might have had other surgeries to really investigate. But it's, you know, there's not enough information here in New Zealand for people who know about it. I had a fantastic surgeon, Sahad Yassari, who was mentored by the head of the Gut Foundation / Stoma Foundation in Auckland. And he actually went back to his mentor and said, I've got this patient who's a bit of a curveball. I don't know how to navigate it. I didn't know he had done that, actually, until I had connected to the Auckland Stoma community after being discharged. And the mentor was there speaking about all the different types of stoma surgeries, the different types. So you have your colostomy, urostomy, elostomy, and then you have the different types of procedures. So I had what is called a Hartmann's procedure, where they fully disconnect the rectum from the large intestine and manage to salvage whatever they can of the large intestine. So I have half a meter left. And then you have others where it's like a fold, where the tube, it's kind of folded over, pinched together, and you have the stoma kind of pinched up at the top, which means there can be a bit of a backwash inside the intestine and leakage and all sorts of other problems. So it was very enlightening and interesting, but it was definitely intriguing to meet him firsthand and hear that he had been the mentor to my surgeon. And I became a bit of a case study for my surgeon, which is why I went back in December for that biopsy to confirm the diagnosis. And of course, to this day, I think what has happened was that my Hirschsprungs itself was in my large intestine that they surgically removed. I mean, I ticked every box, but they couldn't get a sample to confirm the actual diagnosis clinically. which is annoying. But I mean, I still stand by the fact that, like, when you've got every box ticked, then clearly it's obviously there. It's just that they can't get a physical evidence to prove it. I lived my life as best as I could, and it just got to a point where it was a do or die moment, I guess. And I probably should have gone and just ignored my GP when I was visiting her. I should have just gone straight to ED. Like, I could have and should have.
But hindsight's a wonderful thing. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. You know, I mean, there's no way that you would be able to know that at the time. No chance. Yeah. No chance. So, but in terms of the stoma and everything after the surgery, I know you talked about things that you had to do after the surgery, but in terms of life now with the stoma, how is life now sort of compared to where it was pre-stoma?
Really good. Really good. I mean, I reconciled my PTSD and the trauma from the surgery. I am currently unemployed, but that's because the employment situation is really bad in New Zealand right now. It's really bad. And I am about 48 applications deep in trying to find a job. So it's pretty tough. But I mean, I went from not being able to have lactose to enjoying yogurt every day and enjoying milk and all that kind of thing. I do miss steak. I mean, I could possibly have steak, but then you have to really, really, really chew it down. So I kind of just go, okay, well, if it's a risk, I'm going to avoid it. And the same for nuts. Nuts can cause a blockage or internal damage, and it could end up with going back in football surgery to kind of salvage the damage that the nut causes with the stoma. So again, I just cut that out of my diet completely. But it has really kind of resolved the whole intestinal issues, because I went from not having a bowel movement until, you know, 2 weeks time to now having a bowel movement every day or every second day. So there was a bit of an adjustment in realizing that every 2 days is actually healthy to have a bowel movement. Yeah. Instead of every 2 weeks or every month or whatever it was.
Or 5 months as it was.
Yeah. I mean, there is an adjusted kind of thing with, like, I'm going to the gym to try and rebuild my muscles and being able to stand on my feet for long periods of time because the fatigue is real. And there are techniques. I mean, I saw your videos of you doing crunches on Instagram, and I'm going, I can't do.
I just tried to think of an exercise that was stomach related. That was my feeling behind it, and something I could try and get 5,000 done without it. Because I thought, well, you know, I didn't want to go like 5,000 miles or something, because that was never going to happen, or kilometers.
Yeah.
So I had to try and think of something.
Very fair, very fair. But yeah, no, it's definitely an exercise I can't do. So there are various other exercises with strengthening my shoulders and my arms. Cardio is a big one. Assisted weights are really helpful. But lying on my stomach is just a bit of an anxiety-inducing thing. And the other part of it was post-surgery was having the courage to put on a pair of some clothing. I don't know what you call it, but here in New Zealand we call it togs. and go hop into the pool, because the stoma bag is very much kind of stuck to your stomach through like a manuka honey and like a gel or something. It's like a sticky thing that sticks on your skin, so you're worried that water will lubricate it and cause the bag to come off. I've been swimming once post-surgery. And getting dressed was definitely kind of like, don't hyperventilate, just get dressed and go to the pool. You're okay. Yeah. But yeah, it was.
But that's a big thing. That is a huge thing for many reasons. Having, I think you said you've been once, but I think once is great. I mean, the fact you did it at all is amazing. I think to have stoma and then to go in the pool I think is kudos to you, because that's amazing stuff.
Thanks. I do follow a few people on Instagram that actually have ileostomies and colostomies. So you've got Misha, who's Mr. Colitis Crohn's, and there's Ant Locker, I think his name is, and he is the IBD likes. I follow the two of them. Ant and I have had a bit back and forth conversation, but it's so cool for them to advocate on social media about the whole thing, about the process and how they live their life, and seeing that you can still gain a sense of acceptance and love from someone who understands your walk and your health journey, and accepts that, you know, your butthole is on your stomach, basically.
A different place. But no, yeah. They're brilliant, and I know they do so much for, again, I think one was Misha has Crohn's and colitis, and the Ant has IBD. And so even for people who have two different conditions, they still advocate very much for the same thing in terms of stomas. They're both absolutely brilliant. I do follow both of them, so they're really, really good. But it's so good to hear that life is much easier for you now. That's so much good. So much. It's really, really good to hear. Really, really.
I'm still on Alexa
or Instagram,
just to help
Tom's
keep things going every now and then. Because
podcast.
I'm still navigating the diet process and learning how certain foods impact the frequency of movement, and how, you know, there are foods you probably shouldn't eat so much of. I mean, bread and cheese can slow movement down, and then other fibers can increase it. So the Lacto definitely helps. But yeah, I come into accepting my little buddy. I call him Babbles because he makes babbling sounds when gas comes through. It sounds like blowing raspberries, which is why I called it Babbles. So he is now my little buddy that, you know, is part of my life now, and I'm just trying to kind of, I don't know, walk on eggshells in regards to finding a job, because you kind of have to disclose a bit of your health journey, but also declare that it's not going to impact your job.
Exactly, yeah.
And there is I'm definitely facing some stigma around that a little bit. And so it's just trying to find the right words to communicate that to employers without going, I'm not compromised. I've just had an adjustment to my lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. And that takes understanding from the employer, doesn't it? You don't necessarily need to know everything about stomas or anything like that, but it just understanding, you know, and that would go a long way, I imagine.
Yeah. It was great to have this connection. I mean, it took me the better part of a year before I posted my first photo on Instagram of me at the gym going, that was just part of my life, and we're going to try and get healthy. And then when that went off with like a few hundred views, I was like, okay, I'm on to something here. I'm going to add something else now. So I took a photo of me at the cardio I did on the treadmill, and it took me half an hour to do 2 kilometers. I thought, awesome. Okay, so 2 kilometers now. I'll get to 3 and then 4 and then 5, and then I'll go do a marathon sometime next year, fingers crossed. Not a massive one, maybe a half.
Yeah, but absolutely. No, that's so good to hear. No, it has been brilliant. Really, really good to have you on, have this chat, and have a chat about stomas and about Hirschsprungs. And just very quickly before we wrap up, where can people, you mentioned Instagram, where can people find you, follow you, keep up to date with everything that's going on?
Sure. So my handle is at CRJCrawfordNZ, that you can find me by looking up Courtney Crawford.
Fantastic. Well, I wish you the very, very best with your journey. And we'll be following on Instagram to see how you're getting on. Thank you so much for coming on.
Cheers. Thanks, Tom.